Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome back to Well That Aged Well. This week I'm joined by Joelle Rollercoaster. I'm sorry, I messed that up.
It's all right, I'm used to it.
And she has written a book about the topic we are going to discuss today, the Avignon Papacy, which is Avignon and its Papacy, 1309-1417, Popes, Institution and Society, which was published in 2015, and more recently, that was published last year, The Great Western Schism, 1378-1417, Performing Legitimacy, Performing in 2022. And as I mentioned, so you would think that the popes are always rule in Rome, right? But what if I told you that's not the case, because for 70 years, almost half a century, the popes had moved seat of power into France and the Avignon, as that's now called the Avignon Papacy. So let's talk a little bit about background and why they moved to Avignon, of all places in France. Okay. And I want to begin talking a little bit about Rome itself. Was there any internal reasons in Rome why they moved, or what was the state in Rome of the papacy and the Vatican at the time in early 14th century?
All right, so you're asking me a lot of questions, and I'm going to have to be traveling in time. Number one, there is the false assumption that the papacy was always fixed in Rome. People think that because they see a pope in Rome today, not moving any place, well, except for travels, they think that the papacy has always been fixed in Rome, which is not the truth. Because when you think about the medieval century, so the Middle Ages is very long. Number one, the papacy does not have a lot of power until, I would say, the 11th century. It will try to strengthen itself. So by not having a lot of power, it means that it can be manipulated by a lot of other entities, like the Holy Roman Emperor. And that means that he sometimes needs to escape and to move a lot. And I think that there is an historian of the papacy, Italian, called Agostino Paravicini Baliani, actually maybe Swiss, who I think has calculated something like in the 13th century, the papacy may have spent more than 50 years outside of Rome. So people should realize that in the Middle Ages, the papacy is not, yes, it has a couple of palaces in Rome, but it's not stable. It moved to places like Viterbo, to places like Anagni, to places like Perugia. So the papacy moves. So that's one of the first thing. Before I get into why the papacy moved to Avignon, and you interrupt me whenever you whenever you know if you're going too long or if I don't answer what you want me to say. One of the other reason is that the papacy does not have an army, right? The papacy is a power which is an authority, which for us today is an authority which should be only spiritual, but in the Middle Ages, it's an authority which is spiritual and temporal. I think you had Tom Noble, so you may have had discussion about the Carolingians and the relationships between the Carolingians and the papacy. But you can put put a lot of that back. A lot of the issues come from Charlemagne. I call him Chucky. I think it's cute. In any case, if we move toward Rome, so if we move toward the essence of the late medieval papacy, let's say after the 11th century, we have a lot of reform where the papacy is trying to distinguish itself from the control of the Holy Roman Empire. And then eventually the papacy is going to try to clear itself from the, in French, it's ingérence, for all the influence that all of those political authorities have over it. But one of the things that the papacy has a hard time doing is basically controlling the Roman aristocracy. And you cannot deal with the papacy without the idea of control of the Roman aristocracy. So I'm going to slowly get there because I cannot go in 2 seconds as to why the papacy got
Of course.
There. So we have a lot of families which throughout the Middle Ages are going to rotate a pope, which means that you have, I don't know, the Orsini, the Colonna, the Savelli, the Frangipani, the Salviati. Those are all the big names of the papacy in Rome. Every great family has people in the church, as cardinals and as popes. So you can, you know, it's kind of a rotation, but you also need to think about it as rivalry. And all of the big Roman family are implanted in specific quarters of Rome, usually attached to specific old monument. So you have a family close to the amphitheater, one close to the amphitheater or the theater of Marcellus. So that's the way it goes. And then the family, which is going to traditionally for hundreds of years be constantly on the side of the papacy, that family name is Orsini. So to make a long story short, by the late 13th century, we have a pope named Boniface VIII. And Boniface VIII has a grand view of what the papacy should be. And he's trying to be, if you have had anybody discussing the papacy before, one of the greatest medieval pope is Innocent III. Innocent III was a puppet master of Europe. For me, he controlled everything. I mean, he gave us, you know, the John Magna Carta in England. So in any case, what Boniface VIII is going to try to do, so we are in the 1290s and up to 1303, what Boniface VIII is trying to do is that he's trying to consolidate papal power, and he's going to face one of the greatest French king we have. Yes, we have some of them, and his name is Philippe the Fair. Now, Philippe the Fair is known because he's the one who condemned and took over the Knight Templar. So that's usually why, you know, we have enough TV shows about him that people know about him. So Philippe the Fair and Boniface are going to fight to temporize, and eventually there is going to be a big fight over which one holds the greatest power, a king or a pope. And there is going to be a lot of story about money because Philippe the Fair needs money to fight against the Brits. And he's going to take money from the church without really asking the approval of the papacy. The Pope is going to get mad. The Pope is going to say to Philip, you're not a good boy. I'm going to excommunicate you because you are, you know, taking my money without asking me. And then Philip is going to say, but you know what? I'm not listening to you. They are going to be a bunch of papal bulls, bulla, you know, the papal decrees. All of this is going to a climax with Philippe the Fair sending his troop and his main lawyer, Philippe of Nogaret, and then, no, Guillaume of Nogaret, I'm sorry, Guillaume de Nogaret, William of Nogaret, and they're going to go where the Pope was, which was in Anagni. And they are going to rough handle the Pope. They may have even hit him. And within 3 weeks, the Pope is going to die. What you have in the middle of all of this, you have a big fight within the cardinal clan with a cardinal family called the Colonna, Colonnas were always against the Pope, and the Pope had made the Colonnas mad. So it's not a simple story. So Boniface VIII dies. There is going to be a new conclave, a new election. That the person elected is somebody called, I think, Benedict the 11th. Benedict the 11th, oh, by some chances, is going to die very quickly. And there is another conclave in 1304, and that conclave is going to be really problematic because you have infighting with the cardinals. The Colonna, the Orsini, the clan supported the French, the clan supported the Italian, everybody's embroiled. And so the cardinals are going to say, why don't we choose a neutral person? And that neutral person is going to be somebody who was traveling at the time, who was a Gascon, so southwestern French of origin, who was actually not present at the court, you know, during the conclave. And they are going to, his name is Bertrand de Gaulle. I hope I know. Yes, he's a de Gaulle from the de Gaulle family. And they are going to eventually elect him. And that Bertrand de Gaulle is going to take the name of Clement V. But Bertrand is not in Rome at the time. And I don't even know if, I don't remember if the if that conclave to take in Rome or in Perugia. I get mixed up because there are so many, it's so complicated. But in any case, the point is that Bertrand, who is going to take the name of Clement V, is not present during the conclave and is far away. So they're going to recall him, but he's far away in France and he is not able to return quickly to Rome. And he never says that he is going to not return to Rome, but all he's saying is that, you know what, I have a bunch of pressing things to deal with. So I'm going to do my things and eventually I'm going to make my way to Rome. So Clement is going to be crowned in the city of Lyon in the center of France. Actually, his coronation is quite interesting because, you know, it's very popular and some people were on walls watching the procession. And the wall collapsed, people fell on the parade, on the procession, many people died, and the crown fell from the head of the Pope, and one of the jewels fell. So it's kind of a, you know, weird omen for papal coronation. But Clement is in Lyon. As he's in Lyon, France and England are starting to be really at each other's throat. As always, we are getting into, you know, the preliminaries of the Hundred Years' War. And then there is the issues of the Knight Templars. So what, and there is the issues with Philip the Fair, who wants to see the previous Pope, Boniface VIII. He wants to see him condemned. And the person who writes the article of condemnation against Boniface VIII is the exact same person who writes the article of condemnation against the Knight Templar. So we have Templars. We have Boniface VIII affair. Clemens does not want to condemn the previous pope. So all of this needs to be discussed. So Clemens says, I'm going to call a council. And at that council, we are going to decide on all of that. It just happens that he's going to call a council not far from Lyon in the city of Vienne. Vienne is a little bit south of Lyon. In Vienne, there are lots of issues because people cannot find places. So they call the council for like something like 1310. And then the people start arriving, you know, council with all of the bishops, all of the cardinals, maybe some of the abbots. So it's a lot of travel. You need a lot of logistic. Where are we going to put these people? We need to find a place where we are going to stay. And in Vienne, the Pope cannot find anything. And then you think, well, there is that little city of Avignon. So Avignon is not French territory, but Avignon belongs to Provence, to the Count of Provence. At the time, the Count of Provence is a countess. Her name is Joanna, and Joanna is of the Angevin dynasty. And Giovanna is at the same time Queen of Naples and Countess of Provence and Forcalquier. So eventually, Clement is going to say, well, Vienne is not an option for me. I cannot find a place to move my court. Don't forget that these people, most pope, have what you call a familia, a household of something like maybe 200, 300 people moving with them. And then you have the cardinals, we have the same number of people. So that's a substantial number of people. So Clement is going to say, you know what? I think I can find a spot in Avignon, more specifically because Avignon has a very large convent for the Dominicans, and the Dominican convent is a place where I could reside. Avignon belongs to Provence, thus I am out of French control, out of French hands. And then the other advantage is Avignon is close to a papal territory. People always think that papal territories, papal states existed only in Italy, but you have some in France since the Albigensian Crusade. So there is a place called the Contavenison, which was given by the French to the papacy at the end of the Albigensian Crusade. Basically, Avignon chose to go with Toulouse during the Albigensian Crusade. Avignon was punished, lost its independence, was taken by the French crown, and then the Contavenison was given to the papacy, and then Avignon was given to Joanna to the French crown, to the brother of the King of France, who was the Angevin Charles d'Anjou. So it's all very complicated and intricate, but the decision of Clement is not to return to Rome right away because he has pressing affairs to deal with in France, having to do with the King of France wanting to try the previous Pope Boniface VIII, wanting to try the Knight Templars, and Clement is going to call a council. He cannot find location in Vienne. He moves to Avignon. Avignon belongs to the County of Provence, therefore he's outside the clutch of France, and he's close to the Contavenison, which is papal territory. And then the Council of Vienne took place, and then Clement V died. And it's a mess in Rome because there is the papal states are being taken over by the by petty tyrants who control it. The city of Rome itself is uncontrollable, and the popes in Avignon are going to say, we will not return unless the situation in Rome is stable. So that's basically the long story as to why we ended up in Avignon.
I want to talk a little bit about Avignon itself because it's kind of at this point in history, it's not really a prosperous city. It's kind of, as is my understanding is, it's a kind of dirty,
No,
downtrodden
you're wrong.
city.
You're wrong. You're talking like a modern person. Avignon has always been number one. If you look on the map, Avignon is at a very at a far, far better location than Rome is. Avignon is the center of the Rhone, the Alps. Avignon is a crossroad between Spain and territories of the Empire and Italy, between the North, the Empire again, England and the South. Avignon is a perfect crossroad, and Avignon was never poor because of the traffic on the Rhone. Avignon was always a great harbor, a port, and was always a location of commerce. So I don't want to hear medieval dirty cities. Go to San Francisco. Go to Los
That's
Angeles.
fair enough. That's fair
Then
enough. But
we can have a chat. So
like
no, Avignon, you go ahead.
as you mentioned, Pope Clement would die in 19 in, sorry, not 1914, but 1314. I'm a few years ahead of my time there, but The one that will take over is John the 12th. So what made him stay in Avignon and not return to Rome? As you mentioned, Rome was a bit of a mess at the time. And how did John the 12th come to power? And why did he choose to stay? Not to mention the location of Avignon was perfect. Was this one reason why he chose to, hey, this might not be a bad idea after all to have the papacy in Avignon?
Okay, it's John the 22nd.
Sorry,
Not the 12th. So John, we have Clement the 5th, John the 22nd, and Benedict the 12th. I may have done the lapsus. I don't know if I mentioned their name. So Clement is going to take care of the Boniface situation. Boniface will not be condemned. He's going to do his best as taking care of the Templar situation. And then when he dies, John the 22nd is going to be elected. So what is actually very interesting is that it's going to take almost 3 years from the death of Clement the 5th to the elections of John the 22nd. There is a very long vacancy, sede vacante, which has to do with a lot of internal politics, the family of Clement the 5th, who's going to pillage the treasury and all that. But when John the 22nd is elected, he is old. He's like in his 70s. So the cardinals elect him thinking that he is that middle replacement, is going to die soon. And therefore, then we can kind of, settle down and do things. But unfortunately for them, John II gets elected at something like 72, and he's going to live a very long life. So
he's a stubborn fella, isn't he?
Yeah. I like John. I called him, workaholic. So he is going to... he understands that there is a lot of issues and that the papacy, since Boniface VIII and the story of the King of France really intervening, the papacy needs to kind of, rebuild itself as something that you don't mess with. And we have, by then, things are going very bad between France and England. And the papacy specifically wants to really centralize its authority. So the papacy cannot centralize its authority while in Rome, people are still questioning its authority. So John may have wanted to go back. For sure, his successor, Benedict the 12th, wants to go back. Clement the 6th has no interest in going back. Innocent the 6th had no interest in going back. Urban the 5th will go back, then we'll come back to Avignon. And then Gregory the 11th will go back, and then all hell breaks loose. So John is going to focus before he returns the papacy to Rome, which he may have wanted to do or not, but his main focus is centralizing the power and the authority of the church. And how is he going to do that? He needs to refill the coffers of the church. So the big preoccupation of John the 22nd is going to be the administration. How can I centralize the finances? Some people have criticized me for this, but I really call the old John the 22nd a fantastic bureaucrat. A very efficient autocrat. I don't know how you can call, but he's somebody who really had a sense on how do you deal with the administration, and how do you make money. And John the 22nd is going to centralize. Quick examples: benefices. For example, you have a bishop would die someplace, you have an abbot would die someplace, where you need to name people. When you name these people, it's going to be the Pope. It used to be, kings, lords would do that. The Pope is going to centralize that back the way it should be. And then there is a tax to be paid by the newly nominated people. So if you are, let's say, newly named abbot of a place, you need to pay a tax of 1 year of your revenues back to the papacy. He's going to centralize the collations. So he's going to tax all of the quarters. He's going, all of the provinces of the church, and he's going to send merchants to bring in all of the money. So John is so intent on reinforcing the power, the administration, the coffer of the papacy, that dealing with France and dealing with, the Holy Roman Emperor. I mean, I'm cutting short, but it's a very rich history, that he's not going to be willing to move. His successor, Benedict the 12th, it's ironic. Benedict the 12th is going to be interested at once in returning the papacy to Rome, but he's also going to be the one who say, okay, we're staying here for a while. I want a new palace. So Benedict the 12th is the one who starts building very austere. I think he was a Cistercian monk. So he is going to build what we call the old papal palace. Have you been to Avignon?
Never, no. I've been to
Okay.
Provence when I was a child, but I don't think I've been to
Okay,
Avignon
so
as far as I
if you
remember.
look behind me, you see the Tower of Notre-Dame-des-Dents, you see the bridge. I tried to put the picture to give an idea. But if you are facing the palace, on your left, you have the what is called the Old Palace. On the right, you have the new palace of Clement the Sixth. So Benedict the 12th is going to start the building the Old Palace. And actually, anybody who works on the Avignon Papacy and go to the archives right now are in the old palace of Benedict the 12th. So it's actually extremely cool that when you go and work in the archives, you are actually working in the old palace. And again, there are so many things. One of the reasons, so that's Benedict the 12th, who's going to try to return, but he's going to never do it. One of the reasons also why John the 22nd may not have wanted to return is that there are some attempts on poisoning him, and I think he was somewhat freaked out by that. The
There
idea that
wouldn't be.
Yeah, the idea that there is some great stories about a bishop of Cahors trying to poison him by bringing in a poison inside loaf of bread with like puppets, which were like voodoo puppets and stuff like that. So that may have played a part in several things. Number one, that made John think a lot about magic and poisoning and witchcraft. And John the 22nd is the first one who made the link between witches, magic, and heresies. So basically, the church is going to end up, treating witches as heresies because John the 22nd is the first one who did it. And yeah, I think it's important to mention that our John is busy with that, and literally, I think, was traumatized. And then he has, he's famous for also another reason as to why he could not move is the history of the Fraticelli, the division among the Franciscans order. Between what do we do with money, what do we do with poverty, and that big fight with Michael of Cesena and with Bernard Delisieux having to do, well, Saint Francis wanted to be poor, but there is a big difference between use and possession, and Francis was using but not possessing. So anyway, there is a lot of this, there is a lot of trials, and all of this is also taking place in Avignon. And that is going to then lead him to his other big issue. John the 22nd did everything. I can talk more about John the 22nd than
Maybe
any other popes.
in the next episode, maybe when you come back to the book and you talk about John the
No.
22nd.
But then he went crazy saying that he was not a theologian. He tried to change theology over the beatific vision. So I mean, he kind of rock and roll a lot of things. So Benedict, his successor Benedict, is going to establish the old palace. And then when he die in 1342, he's going to be succeeded by one of the grandest of all the Avignon Pope, who is Clement the Sixth. And Clement the Sixth is going to be, the one who is going to embellish, if you want, the Papal Palace by going from the old palace of Benedict the 12th and building a brand new palace. So basically, when you go to Avignon today, and if you face the palace, you see the grand entry door, that's going to lead you into the new palace, which is the palace of Clement the Sixth. And then when you walk on your left and you go toward the archives, unfortunately, the archive are going to eventually move. But when you walk toward the archive, you have the La Tour Campane, which is the tower where the archives are. That's all the old palace and the old church of Benedict the 12th. What's interesting about the palace that Clement the Sixth built is that Clement the Sixth realized that he would not. Clement the Sixth is maybe the most French of all the French pope. All of those guys are southwestern French, and I'm Provençal, so they are all speaking Languedoc rather than Languedoil, so they are closer to the Provençal than they are to the Parisian. And one thing I forgot to say, when you look at the bridge here, which is in the background, which should be oriented differently, but in any case, if you stand on the bridge, you see the chapel at the beginning on the Avignon side. So that's Avignon papal property. And then the rest of the bridge from the middle on belongs to France, because the city on the other side of the Rhone is called Villeneuve, and Villeneuve belongs to the King of France. So you have in the archives tons of rivalry over things which happened on the bridge, and people fighting, saying, well, that part of the bridge is my responsibility, my authority. No, it's my responsibility. The most things have to do with killing people. So when you were condemned to death in Avignon, you were thrown or hanged from the bridge. And of course, if you are hanged by the Avignonese authority, you should not be hanged from the French side of the bridge. So that gives you an idea. So Clement the Sixth is going to, I'm going back to the history of the palace. Clement the Sixth is, even if he would have liked to stay in Avignon, is not going to be able to move, because at the time of Clement the Sixth, we have 1348. And what do we have in 1348? We have the Black Death, which means that nobody is moving during the Black Death. It's going to kind of change his frame of mind, in the sense that when he built, so he started building his palace before the Black Death, but even during after the Black Death, where the, I think he's going to survive the Black Death of like 3 or 4 years. He's going to realize that he stays, that he's staying, because again, nobody, it's like COVID, nobody was, thinking about moving and traveling. And what he's going to do, which is very interesting, is that Rome, the city, is used by the papacy for liturgical function. So Rome is always used. You go, for example, the papacy is staying at the Lateran, but he's going to be enthroned at St. Peter. So there is all of the great churches of Rome are always used. You go to Santa Maria Maggiore, I mean, all of the, or to St. Paul, all of the great churches of Rome are used for liturgical function. Clement the Sixth is the first one who is going to realize, well, I'm the Pope, but I'm not moving any soon. I just build a new palace, and I'm going to replicate Roman liturgy within the palace. So what is very original with Clement the Sixth is that all of the liturgy, which in the Middle Ages used to be taking place over all of the space of Rome is now going to take place within the Papal Palace. That's one of the interesting things.
Something I want to ask, Michelle, I do believe if I know that I mean, your papacy history, which I probably don't, but I want to ask, I believe the idea of, because you know, Catholics believe in purgatory, that you have to cleanse your soul. And I believe at the time of the purgatory, I don't remember when, but that the idea that you can purchase your way to kind of skip the line, kind of a VIP, to that you can skip the line of purgatory comes during the Avignon papacy that
yes.
later be criticized by Martin Luther King. Not King, but Martin Luther.
Yes.
And let's talk a little bit about the idea that you can purchase your way out of purgatory. I believe that comes, I don't remember when, but I believe that comes from the Avignon papacy.
That is linked to the Jubilee. So you remember the Benedict Boniface the Eighth, who was, you know, hit by the troops of Philip the Fair. Boniface the Eighth was the first one to come up with the idea of a jubilee. So what is a jubilee? A jubilee is we are going to honor specific monuments, specific things in Rome. We're going to make Rome a site of a pilgrimage. And and whenever you visit specific spaces, you get indulgences. And so that started really with Boniface the Eighth. But what Clement the Sixth did, because Clement the Sixth did, so what Clement the Sixth did after 1348 is that instead of having a jubilee every 100 years, like initially was supposed to be when Boniface the Eighth set it up, what Clement the Sixth did is that he said, you know what, we're going to bring the jubilee every 50 years. Which is even better because at the time, the 50 years would fall like in the 1350s. But the Jubilee is not bringing people, pilgrims to Avignon, it's bringing pilgrims to the city of Rome. All of this is to say to the Romans, we know we're not returning to you, but we're bringing you money because the pilgrims bring money. Cool. And with this, he is going to create more or less the idea that indulgences are going to be received whenever the pilgrims travel throughout all of the churches. So let's say you go to St. John Lateran, well, you're going to get by saying one, you know, my father, Paternoster, you're going to get 40 days of indulgences. So this is codified with the Jubilee of Clement the Sixth. I am not a specialist of that, but I don't think I'm wrong. Maybe some of your people in the audience may correct me, but that's the way I understand that it happened. But it's linked specifically to the Jubilee, and then other popes are going to then take that idea of getting, you know, indulgences from pilgrimage site and then are going to, you know, run with it.
So I want to talk about the city of Avignon as well, and how, because you mentioned the building of the papacy palaces, but it's my understanding as well that it was transformed mildly. But while you're correcting me earlier, it was not the dirty little town, medieval town that people think it was, but it was still transformed under the popes of the Avignon papacy. So let's talk a little bit about the transformation of Avignon under the papacy.
I thought I had, well, it would have been, do you want me to share my screen and show you
map? Yeah, please, that would be great. Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I'm sorry, but I'm really basic with Zoom, but you can, if you wish to, would be great.
No, I cannot do because you disable me, but
sorry. I'm really basic with Zoom still. So I've been doing it for years.
Well, you know, I spend my life with COVID teaching online, so we have some experience. So I'm looking at my map here. So picture an hexagon or something like that, and then draw two circles. A small circle in the middle and then a larger circle. So basically what you have, the original Avignon The Avignon was a very decent size, maybe 5,000 inhabitants when the Pope arrived. That Avignon has a bunch of Franciscan Dominican convent, which is a very large convent, which Clement V had then, worked on also when he had moved there. Within that initial circle, you have what we call the old medieval city. Within that old medieval city, you have a first set of walls, right, which enclose it. When the papacy moved, when Clement moved, this is what he moved in. So you have, if you can, let me look at my picture here. So where you see the Tower of Notre Dame des Dents, you have a big rock, that's called the Rocher des Dents. And this is where you had the old Episcopal Palace. And then the Dominican convent would be on the western side of the city, the Franciscan on the eastern side. And everybody is going to be moving the court, the papal courts, the scribes, the secretaries, the cardinals. Everybody is going to move into that within those old walls. So, I mean, the perimeters is not very, very large. And when the papacy arrived, number one, the Avignonese, so the Romans were very mad because they lost a source of revenue. You know, think about a city being a capital and then you lost your capital. So the Avignonese, contrary to the Roman, were tremendously happy to have, that papacy moving in. And
it must have been a great honor as well to house the power of the next king to God as well, to have the Pope in your city.
I cannot know this. I cannot know what they thought from the type of documentation they
had. Of course, yeah.
I can tell you that they were happy to tax. So I think they were happy to make... to make their money. But one of the main issue of Avignon is that it's not big enough for the papal court. And the cardinals are moving in. So again, we're talking about thousands of people, an influx of thousands of people. So what the cardinals and the court started to do is that they would take clusters of houses and clothe them with a chain and say, well, this is my palace. So they would rent. I mean, the prices of rent went up like crazy. They bought, they rented, and then they realized this is not working. So what happened is that the court moved within those old walls, and then the people moved outside. And then eventually, because space was not available within the old walls, more and more and more people moved outside until in the 1350s, starting with Urban V, they said, you know what, we are going to now build a second set of walls, specifically during the Hundred Years' War, when you have companies of mercenaries who come and, ransack the surrounding and attack the city, try to attack the city. So there is going to be a second set of walls being built. So Avignon is tremendously transformed physically because of the presence of the papacy. So you have that interplay between an old center where the wealthy people and the court live, and then outside the initial 12th century walls, we're going to have the newest arrival, all of the immigrants. When I worked on the population of Avignon, you may have 50 or 60,000 people living in Avignon in, mid and 14th century, when you had 5,000 at the beginning, before the papacy. And what is also tremendous about Avignon is the fact that you have, even the Black Death could not change the numbers, which means that even though people died in droves, more people came in to renew the population constantly. So it's really an attraction for immigration, which means that people left, people died specifically with the Black Death, but people came in, and people came in from all over the all over Europe, from northern Germany to England to Scotland to from Spain. We have people, so it must have been also a multilingual city.
So, but what about the people in Rome? So you mentioned a little bit that they weren't happy that the Pope were leaving, but how did they feel the absence of the popes during the Avonian papacy? What they felt? How did the attitude towards the popes change? Did it change at all in Rome and Roman society?
So what's interesting, it's again ambivalence. Basically, the papacy is gone. The Romans have lost their primordial source of revenue. Okay, having the papacy in your city brings fun, brings traveler, brings money. You have merchant, money changers. You have inns. You have hotel. So all of that is gone. But with the Pope gone, the city becomes again an independent commune because traditionally, politically, Rome is had created a kind of communal republic, but which was controlled by the papacy. So with the papacy gone, actually the communal authorities of Rome actually are in control of their cities, and they like that. And one of the things they did not like when the papacy returned at the end of the 14th century is the fact that, yeah, it's great. They are recovering all of their income because their city is going to become a capital again, but they are losing their political autonomy. And the political autonomy of the Roman is very, very important for them. And they will lose it completely after 1398. So it's ambivalent. Money, no political freedom. No money, political freedom. And there is a lot of clan infighting, aristocratic infighting, over this.
Let's talk a little bit, because you mentioned as well that there were popes that would try to return to Rome, but still,
Sure.
like we said, the Black Death would stop them from doing so. And of course, let's talk a little bit about how
Okay.
some popes did try to return to Rome, but they still kind of changed their mind and still kept for another 3 years in Avignon, and that's still. No, they tried, but they did not return initially.
Number one, since the 13th century, Enricus de Segusio, a cardinal called the Ostiensis, one of the great legal entity, writer of the Middle Ages, had said that Rome is where the Pope is, which means that the papacy was not attached to a specific location, but to a specific person. Which means that as long as we have a pope, wherever the pope is meaningless. So I think that's one of the things I should have said first, which for me is so evident, but it may not be evident for everybody. This is why the papacy had no issue traveling before. So why do we have the papacy returning? Well, number one, the papacy has an historical sense that the papacy has always been in Rome. So the Avignon Pope always had in the back of their mind that it was their duty to return. But before they could return, they needed to stabilize, they need to pacify the Papal States. And the first one who is going to really start pacifying the Papal States with a very heavy hand, pacify with wars, is going to be Innocent VI, and then his use of Cardinal Albornoz as a papal legate. And Albornoz is going to system is going to be used by Innocent VI and by Urban V also, but Albornoz is going to basically hire mercenaries troops. You have heard of names like John Hawkwood, for example. Hire mercenaries troops, the greatest, captain of mercenaries of his time. And by hiring mercenaries, he's going to be able, little by little, to regain the Papal States. One of the things that he is very smart with is that he reconquered the Papal States, who supposedly were held by so-called vicars who were the Pope representative on those lands. But take cities like Bologna, the Visconti, Milan, and stuff like that. But these vicars, Giovanni di Vico, around Rome, these vicars were supposed to take care of the papal state for the Pope, but they took care of the papal states for themselves. So Albornoz is going to go in and he's going to kick the butts of those vicars. But smartly enough, he's going to negotiate with them and tell them, I have defeated you now. I am willing to rehire you, but you are now going to be obeying to me. So Albornoz is actually very smart in the way he's going to do this. And by the time we get to Urban V, at the death of Innocent VI, which is like in the 1360s, Albornoz has done a good job enough of reconquering the papal states. We have had by then, the Avignon popes always felt that Avignon was a better spot to deal with the Hundred Years' War, to deal between the French and the English. Something that we should not underestimate is the effort that the popes and their legates put in to bring peace between France and England. So they were located in Avignon. They were closer to the battlefield. Gascony and all that is, and Aquitaine is not far. And they really tried their best. They really tried hard. And they really took their pacifying role in the Hundred Years seriously. So by the 1360s, the French have been whooped at the Battle of Crécy in 46. By 56, what is it? We have then we have the Treaty of Brétigny, was the Battle of Poitiers in 56. The French have been losing battles and are negotiating with the Brits. So the situation, that phase of the Hundreds War has been coming down. We have had the Black Death. The Papal States are more or less pacified. So Urban V is going to say, okay, I'm returning. And we have all of the details of the return of Urban V. He is going to, so Urban V is elected after Urban VI, so after 1362. And by 1367, he is going to organize Avignon. He's going to divide the curial administration. He's going to say the treasury, the chancery is staying in Avignon. I'm taking with me some other organism, and I'm going back to Rome, and the rest can come. He's going to come with me once I'm settled. He's going to organize the status of the population. So there is some, good amount of thinking for the move. And then you get to Viterbo, and shortly after you arrive in Viterbo, Cardinal Albornoz die. Viterbo is rebelling, so that's not a very good omen for Urban's that the city, basically one of the first city which used to be a papal city, Viterbo, is going to be rebelling against him. He's going to go to Rome. He tried to settle down in Rome. And the city is rebelling against him also. So things did not go well for Urban, and it did not take him long to realize, you know what? The situation is not as pacified as I thought it would be. There is a lot of, ingoing between some of the papal states trying to rebel. You have the situation in Milan. It's kind of a complicated situation. All of this is exploding, and then the Pope is going to say, you know what, I'm going back. So Urban V, leaving 67 in 1367, and he's back in Avignon in 1370. And then his successor, Gregory the 11th, will in 30. So Gregory the 11th is elected when? In 1370, 71? Something like that. I don't have it. 1370, I think, because Urban V is coming back, dies very quickly afterward. And Gregory is going to be elected in Rome, but we'll say pretty quickly that we need to pacify Rome and we will return, which he did. So then they
And
return.
history has had a fair share of anti-popes as well, but were there during the absence of the popes that when they stayed in Avignon, were there ever attempts to be put an anti-pope in the Vatican in Rome, that there was someone else trying to put an anti-pope in the stead? the absence of the real part.
So then, actually, it's interesting because what you're saying is what a lot of people mix up. We have a regular Avignon papacy lasting from 1309 to 1377 when Gregory the Seventh leave. Gregory 11th leave. Gregory leaves Avignon, settled down in Rome, dies in Rome. When he dies in Rome, there is a conclave opening in Rome. And that conclave is going to be infamous because during that conclave, they are supposedly a lot of violences. I've written a book about that. And the violence is just ritualized violence, which happens every time a pope dies. But in any case, the cardinals are going to elect a pope. That pope is going to be called Urban the Sixth. But that pope is kind of going to freak out while he's pope, and he's going to say to the cardinals that they are spending way too much money. And the cardinals are going to be very unhappy with the man they elected. And the cardinals are going to say, you know what? We were tricked into electing him, and his election was not legitimate. Why was it not legitimate? Because while we were in conclave, the crowd outside was threatening to kill us. So we used expedient means. We elected that guy when we really did not want to elect him, even though they really elected him and they crowned him and stuff like that. But that man turned into somebody that they didn't like. So they are going to more or less depose him. And then they are going to move out of Rome, go to Fundy next to Naples, and they are going to elect another cardinal. And that other cardinal was Robert of Geneva, who took the name of Clement the Seventh. Clement the Seventh and Urban the Sixth are going to fight with their, you know, mercenary troops.
If I may, this will not be the Clement Seventh that we, of course, associate
no,
with
there are
the
two.
King. This was
yes.
a different Clement
That's a
the
different,
Seventh. Just want to state.
Yes.
Make it clear.
Yes. So we have a Clement the Seventh with one of the Pope of the Schism who ruled from 1378 to 1394. And then you have the Clement the Seventh of the Sack of Rome of 1527. So that Clement the Seventh is going to fight against Urban the Sixth. And then he's going to basically lose the fight in Italy, and that Clement the Seventh is going to bring his side of the papacy back to Avignon, which means that by 1379, we have two popes. We have one in Avignon, and we have one in Rome. The one in Avignon has a bunch of cardinals and has his court. The one in Rome has a bunch of cardinals and has his court. And this is what we call the Great Western Schism. And that situation is going to last until the Council of Constance, where first the Council of Pisa tried to solve it in 1409. That flunked because that brought a third line of pope. And then the Council of Constance between 1414 and 1417 solved the issue by electing one. But the issue is that people always think that the pope in Avignon was an anti-pope. No. You have a pope in Avignon, you have a regular papacy in Avignon until 1378, and then you have what we call the Clementist obedience. But for the people in France, for the people in Avignon, for the people in Scotland, that was the true pope. So modern day, some people call them anti-pope, but it's ahistorical because the church has never taken a stance on who was the legitimate pope during the schism. So we have two legitimate pope. We just happen to have one in Rome and one in Avignon. That's where you wanted to go?
I want to end because we are going to round up soon.
Yes.
But I want to end with what is the legacy of the Avignon papacy, and how did what would you say? How does the people of Avignon remember the papacy, if they remember it at all? Around, are the people in Avignon today aware that there even was a papacy
Oh, yeah. Oh,
in
yes.
Avignon?
Yes. Number one, when you go to Avignon in the summer, there are tons of tourists. And lots of people still come in pilgrimage to Avignon, to the palace, because it was the residence, of the papacy. You have the great theater festival taking place in the summer also. Simply by the layout, the city is still a beautiful medieval city. You can still walk around the 14th century walls. It's roughly 5 kilometers. So the physical presence of the palace, the physical presence of the palaces built by the cardinals, the papal palace, all of this, the bridge of Avignon, the Pont d'Avignon, all of this makes that it's still imprinted. But for the history of the papacy, the Avignon Pope centralized the papacy like nobody else. And whenever you go into an office today in Norway, me in France, or in the US, and you do paperwork and you go through red tapes and you go through the administration, to a large extent, the Avignon papacy really created what we call bureaucracy. Efficient bureaucracy, well, efficient, I don't know how efficient it was, as efficient as our own administrations are, but historically, collection of taxes and administration, that's what we owe to the Avignon papacy. So beautiful city and the administration.
Thank you. I think we're going to round it up there. I hope you had a decent overview of what the Avignon papacy was, and that they actually did not always reside in the Rome and the Vatican. But before you return, thank you again so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a pleasure to have you
Thank
here.
you.
Before you go, do you have anything you want to promote on the social media where people might find you if they have questions about the Avignon papacy? Where can people buy your books if they want to read more about the Avignon papacy?
Whatever. You can find the books on Amazon. If you have Cambridge Core, you can access my books. I have a website on the site of the University of Rhode Island. I'm still active. You will find my email there if you need to be in touch with me. That's all I can say.
Thank you so much for coming on again. It's been,
You take
again,
care.
this has been about that age 12. My name's Alan. This is we are available on social media on @H2O on Instagram and Twitter /X. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts these days. If you are on Spotify, of course, give us 5 stars. That would help us out a lot. Or write a review on Apple Podcasts. If you are on YouTube, please like, share, and subscribe. Make sure to check out some other episodes. I'm sure you're going to find something of interest over there. My name's Alan, and I'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.